start. So good morning, my name is Carl Meacham, and I'm the director here at the Americas Program. This is a nice, cozy sort of environment for this. I think this, the developments of the election on Sunday, I think caught people by surprise. There's been so much going on right now with Venezuela and with other issues that I don't think anybody really thought that this election was going to be as close as it was. I'm going to let Doug go through all of the different details having to do with Sunday. This is the first, this is the second of a two-part series on El Salvador and what to expect on the elections. Doug Farah is one of my senior associates, and he's also president of IBI Consultants. And I'm very happy to be able to just be able to call him on the phone and say, hey man, want to come and brief everybody with the diligence on these issues. So I'm really happy to have him again. As usual, this is all on the record. These sessions end up going audio on the audio, and hopefully they end up going viral and people like them and that sort of thing. What I'm going to do, since we are a closed or a smaller group, is I'm just going to go around so he knows who you are. I did give him a list of the folks who are coming, but I also see folks that RSVP'd later, so I just want to make sure that he knows who's here. So I'm going to start on my left over here.
Hi, my name is Britta Clint. I work with the Department of the Navy doing transnational crime organizations in Central America.
My name is Cesar Bolaños. I also work in the same shop where she works.
Great. Hi, good morning. My name is Monica Suber. I'm at Peace Corps.
Stanley Keene. I'm the Regional Director for Latin America and the Caribbean for Cooperative League United States of America.
Hello. My name is Colungia. I'm doing an internship at the OAS.
Kara Huntley. I'm working with McLarty Associates. I'm here on behalf of Stephen Dine.
I'm Megan Van Leeuwen. I'm the acting team leader for Latin America for the USAID Office of Transition Initiatives.
Great. So if you could just take us through basically what happened on Sunday, and then obviously the implications, what this means, and I guess what scenarios we could see going forward.
Great. Well, thank you, Carl. For those of you who don't know, I guess I probably have a speaker bias. I've been doing Salvador since 85 in the middle of the war, and then on through the peace process into the current iteration of what I would call confusion, chaos, especially in the Northern Triangle. I think like most of us, I thought that with Sachem getting within a half a point in the first round, that the second round was going to be pretty much a cakewalk, and that it would be easy, if not a huge walkover, at least you'd have a significantly strong mandate. I think some of the things that led me to believe this was, the FLN for the first time had incumbency of the presidency, and they had more resources than not in for the first time in history. You had the Ottawa money flowing in, which that coupled with Funes, what I think many would legitimately argue is his illegal use of the presidency to push the FLN campaign, his wife getting involved in migrating over, certainly skirted the edge of legality and not overtly illegal in how they participated. But with all of those advantages, it seemed that the FLN was well positioned. Funes remains relatively popular. He was not a despised incumbent. And Arena suffers from what a lot of aging parties suffer from. They have a lot of bad eggs that came out. Paco Flores's corruption scandal certainly didn't help Arena, reminded everyone of how corrupt Arena was. Saca was already expelled from the party for his corruption. Calderon Solis sort of migrated into the background. So the only historic figure of any sort of validity or power that Arena had is Freddy Cristiani, who's quite old and not in good health and not wanting to participate as much as he's been forced to keep Arena together. So what did we see going into the second round? I think that I had heard this consistently, but I didn't believe it when I was down there, that a lot of Areneros wanted to punish the historic Arena leadership by not voting, to scare them. They were really scared when Sanchez and came within that close of the first round, and they got out to vote. They then mobilized in the second round. I think it's also true, I mean, I ended up getting, got 400,000 more votes. The turnout went from 53% to 60%, 53% I think being the historic low since the electoral process. I don't know if any of you have been following El Salvador for as long as I have, but if you recall the early elections, particularly the immediate post peace process election, we had this huge euphoria and outpouring of people in the streets, even though it was clear in those days that I didn't know that the FLN wasn't going to win. You had massive mobilization, two civic campaigns. It's certainly diminished since then. So, I had heard also that, from people who would know, and I was surprised by this until the second round happened, that Jose Luis Merino, who runs the money for the Petróleos Group and is funding the FLN's campaign, was really unhappy after the first round, saying that we spent all of this money and we didn't do anything but mobilize our bases. We didn't get past our techo histórico, what we should have, our historic thing, which is not true. They got a little bit past that, and that he was really upset that they hadn't won the first round, given that they had put millions and millions of dollars into this and now spent on it considerably, which I thought was sort of an overreaction until you see the second round. It's clear he saw that they didn't have a lot of growth potential there, and that they were, if Arena were able to mobilize, they would be hammered. And then you have, I think, what pollsters are saying. I find this, I wouldn't say hard to believe, I think it may be overestimated, but it's certainly in the middle class, I think it played a significant part, is the Venezuela situation. The fear that Sánchez Serén's embrace of Alba and going that direction, talking about going that direction quickly, was going to lead them into a situation where you'd have rioting in the streets in Venezuela style thing. So I think that's all. And Arena, I think, did a couple of things right after doing almost nothing right in the first round. One was getting rid of Paco Flores and getting him back under the rock he should be under. The second was successfully courting the SACA vote, the SACA Unidad people, who obviously didn't follow their leader on who to vote for and migrated massively back to Arena, which is their traditional home. And those who sat out the first round, a lot of them clearly came back into the fold on the second round, I think partly because the Arena candidacy did two things in the second round: to stop talking about Manoludo so much as they had the first time. Although I think that there is a great deal of anxiety about what's going to happen with the gangs and how the murder rate now almost back to where it was before the truce, etc. That there's significant concern about that. But I think the Manoludo rhetoric did not help them at all, and they have this sort of lingering image of corruption and chaos, which they fought hard. They came out much more sophisticated, better designed, and the much better designed publicity campaign than the second round. The first, I don't know if you followed it, was really abysmal. I mean, it was just scary bad. They were actually spending money to find people to tell them how to make idiots of themselves that way. So, and you have you have on the Alba front, constant flow of resources into the FMLN. And I think the FMLN, except for Jose Luis Merino and some of the other folks, were enormously confident that this would be an easy walkover. So where does that leave us? I think the most disturbing thing to me is the post-electoral behavior of Arena. They've immediately reverted to calling on the military, although they should know by now they have no friends in the military left. that era is over. But their sort of knee-jerk reaction to almost call for a coup to protect their victory, I think, is very disturbing. I think that the FMLN has been much better. I think that Sánchez Serén calling for a sit-down dialogue, let's look at a Pacto Nacional to do this, is recognition. I mean, I think the striking thing about the election to me in macro terms, and why I think you see parties see Sánchez that are doing this, is that the FMLN probably won the elections, and they're in a much weaker position than they were, and Arena lost, and they're in a much stronger position than they were. So you have this ironic sort of switching of positions of power. And one thing that I think Arena, that FMLN has learned, particularly Jose Luis Merino, has learned in the last go-round, and I think he's managing a lot of what's happening with the Frente out front, is that they've learned how to negotiate on the business front. They will sit down with any businessman and cut a deal that's mutually beneficial to them. And so I don't think the idea of having them sit down on a round table and sort of negotiate out what they can do is implausible. If ARENA decides that that's the best way it can get into to keep some levers of power. I think the basic breakdown in the FMLN is you have the Meninoites, the Communist Party folks, who are deeply involved, I would argue, in criminal activities, but also with Venezuela, et cetera. And you have a very clean sort of anti-corruption FMLN, which has been purged out over time, but still exists, Gerson Martinez and that crowd, that are fighting an internal battle, I think would say, for the soul of the Frente. And you have ARENA in relatively complete disarray. They got this because they scared the crap out of themselves and got into this, but they have no, I don't think anyone would argue that Norman Quijano is a leader of historic stature for them that will sort of rebuild the party in great and lasting ways. They have no bench strength, and they have, if you look at how they operate internally, they more or less imploded. Part of their problem in the first round, and I guess some of this was solved in the second round, was that many of their traditional business folks just sat on their hands. They didn't fund the campaign. Not only did they not vote, they didn't fund the campaign. Partly because many of the traditional, what we used to call it, oligarchy in El Salvador, have Central American businesses now. They're not Salvador focused. They don't care as much what happens in El Salvador. It's not their little playground anymore. Central America is a much bigger playground. So you see a lot of them with huge, in relative terms, Guatemala, Panama, Nicaragua's booming like crazy, where these guys are all building up their business empires, and so they're not as concerned and as, don't stick their noses deeply into the political politics of El Salvador as they used to. I think it's a little disappointing to me that the Tribunal Supremo isn't going to do an entire recount. I think that their decision just to recount a few of the mesas that were in dispute is probably, in an election where you have 2.9 million voters and 6,000 vote margin, recounting the entire thing would probably not be a bad idea for the tranquility of the population. I understand the argument that even if ARENA got all those votes, it still wouldn't overturn the results, so why bother? But I think that if there were a credible full recount, that you would probably save yourself a lot of anguish down the road. I think ARENA is, let's say, reverting to its worst tendencies. It's hard to know what the FMLN is doing internally. They manage themselves internally much better than ARENA does. But I would say, if Sanchez said Ed is coming out and calling for a national pact, I would argue that he understands his position of weakness suddenly, and Ed that negotiating, which is Medina's strong point, is probably their best way forward. And I think this probably, I would hope, except for his immense personal wealth, signal the end of Saka. I think Saka is the third way that even really smart people like Joaquin Villalobos were hoping to push forward. Turned out to be pretty much a bust. I think given his enormous personal wealth of inexplicable origin, he may be staying in the political game for a while, they're trying to, he really wants power, but I think as a movement, it's pretty much over. So I think going forward, I don't know what's gonna happen. I think that a great deal will depend on the transparency of the Tribunal Supremo Electoral. Chicas is definitely FMLN, and there's no getting around that. The question is, can he do something that's seen as nonpartisan? I'm not sure anything he did would satisfy ARENA. I think it matters a lot more if he satisfies the international observer community and the voting in the upper middle class voting sectors there, because they're the ones who will challenge him. I think ultimately, as I think Alfaro wrote today, this is the biggest challenge since the peace process for the democratic transition there. And you have a nation that is obviously deeply, deeply polarized, in which almost 50-50. Although I would argue that ARENA is much diminished, and I think if you look historically, the Frente has gained, ARENA's lost, no question. But they haven't been able to get past that. I think finally I'll just quote saying that I think the choice of Sanchez Serén to placate or to quiet down the historic bases of the Frente was probably necessary internally for the Frente to do, but a really bad choice as a candidate face for the FMLN. The reason they won in 2008-2009 was Funes wasn't Frente, right? He could bring the Frente together or get their votes out, but he wasn't Facundo Guadalalo. He wasn't any of the certainly wasn't Chefe Grano. And this was sort of a revert, which I understand the deep disappointment the Frente has with Funes and their deep sense of betrayal of his behavior, that they would want to go to someone that they know and trust. But I think as an electoral strategy, a massification strategy, is probably a mistake. I think almost anyone else that wasn't of the historic leadership probably would have had an easier time of this in the second round than Sanchez had ended. So I'll leave it there. Clearly, many of you have spent a lot of time in Central America, so I'm happy to have a discussion.
So before we open it up, so is a recount possible? And is there what would be the body that would sort of be the definitive one in giving a result?
The Tribunal Supremo Electoral is the maximum defining word. They could go for a recount, a total recount. They have said they're not going to. They're only going to review 28, the number keeps changing, between 28 and 40. Mesas in disputa that they're going to review, but their argument is that if Arena won all of those, they would get to like 4,000 votes, so there's a 6,000 vote difference, so there's no point in, you don't have to redo everything. I think that there is enough anxiety out there that an internationally monitored recount would probably take the disinflate the bubble. But they don't seem like that.
And when Norman Quijano, and I'm sort of paraphrasing, when he says that he'll protect their victory till the death, is that an empty sort of threat, or what can we expect?
I think it's a play to the bosses. I mean, he went through this really unfortunate phase in the election, too, where he spoke, if you watched, he did a few commercials about the mottos, where he sounded just like Babuzon at the height of the Death Squad days. We know who you are. They're coming to get you. We are the only ones who can defend you. Just typical Arenero, old style 1980s stuff. He sort of snapped out of that and came back. But I think that when he's desperate, his default position is to play with his bosses. I don't think, there are certainly, I think, armed groups on all sides that exist. I don't think there's anyone willing to pull them out onto the streets right now. That's my sense. I just don't think it would be viable. I think, I just don't think that. I don't think they're going to be mobilized in that direction, at least not for a long time, unless there were clear fraud and all. But Arenero's love to talk about fighting to the death and defending the bandera, and the patria. So they like to say it.
Let me take some questions, sir.
When is the
formal... Just identify yourself.
Oh, Stanley Kane, sure. Okay. When is the official announcement going to be made?
They said today, but I don't know. They said Sunday was going to be Sunday, and they said Monday, and now it's Tuesday. So I think there's probably an enormous amount of horse trading going on, or talks about horse trading going on behind the scenes. I think the Tribunal Supremo, I think, will... they've indicated they're going to officially announce on just that, the 6,000... 300, whatever, 29 votes, whatever it is, will hold up, so they're going to go ahead and do that. They seem to be holding off in the hopes that there can be some general consensus that this is not a disputed election and avoid a long, protracted one. So I would guess that that's what's happening, but I don't know what, I think maybe the Tribunal doesn't even know when they're going to do it.
There are a lot of implications to this. And there's a lot of interests, as you mentioned. One of them, has to do with the United States and the region, issues having to do with narco trafficking, et cetera. Do you think that there's going to be, is there any fallout from this as the United States? I'm assuming the United States has to be very careful in what it says and not show any sort of preference either way, because we have so much on the line with issues having to do with narco trafficking, but other issues as well. How do you see this going forward? What's going to happen with Sanchez Cedén and his relationship with the United States? How do you see that going?
Well, what I've been surprised at in the last 6 or 8 months is how deeply soured the relationship between the U.S. and the FMLN has grown. There was a long time when Funes was viewed as, you know, somebody you could work with on the left, elected Democrat, the moderate, blah, 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 all that stuff. I think his personal behavior, his personal addiction habits, his publicly insulting the ambassador, his publicly insulting Senator Leahy, all of those things have made him a much less attractive figure than he was, besides the massive corruption of the things that, that he's been engaged in. And I think, I mean, I was shocked when I was down there just before the first round to talk to the FMLN, when they were saying, okay, you know, so what are we going to do with the U.S.? And I was like, well, that's your business, but you have a serious problem. They were shocked, and these are smart people, that the United States or anybody outside of El Salvador viewed Funes as an FMLN president. He's not FMLN. Anybody said yes, but he ran as an FMLN candidate. He was elected as FMLN, so to us, the outside world, we think he's FMLN. I said, well, we broke with him, we don't like him, which is all true, but it doesn't help him here. Sanchez, it ends, depending on who tells the story, participation in, or at least presence at, the burning of American flags and chanting with 9/11, I think badly hurt him. Mm-hmm. Either he didn't act because he didn't understand the situation, or he was more proactively involved in fomenting it. There's no question Sanchez Cerén is much more ideological and much more driven by from coming out of the war. But you have to remember, Sanchez Cerén kept his arsenal in La Rosa and Santa Rosa in Nicaragua that blew up in 1992. That was Sanchez Cerén's arsenal. And it had documentation from every terrorist group in the world stuck in there, as well as all his weapons, all the weapons and all that stuff, including Lori Barris in Peru and all of her documents and stuff. So he was of the five comandantes, the most resistant to a negotiated settlement and the most skeptical of it going forward for many years. Now, how that will play out, I don't know, because you do have some really smart, and I would say, clean people in the FMLN who really want to sort of make it what they thought Funes could help them make, which was a left that was able to govern cleanly, able to implement their social programs, able to do all the sort of good stuff they want without dragging in all the corruption and the externalities of the deep Venezuela involvement stuff that Ramiro and others have helped engineer the FMLN into at this point. So yeah, I think he's going to have a really tough time. Mm-hmm. I mean, what I told him, and I think that it's not a secret, it's fairly obvious, the Republicans will never like them in Washington. And they pissed off the Democrats by going after Leahy and McGovern and people who have defended them. Really stupid. they don't have a lot of friends left. And I don't think they understand the depth of that. And for whatever reason, I don't know the ins and outs of it, the embassy down there has really, really cooled its relations with FMLN. Mm-hmm. I think some of the reason because there are significant corruption and other issues in there, as there will be with that. I mean, it's not, I don't know, like what I keep arguing is, yeah, I say all these things about Medina and the FMLN. I think most of it is as it should, but I think Arena would do largely the same thing if they could. They just don't have access to power right now. I don't think it's a good versus evil. I think it's an endemic corruption. I think Tony Saca showed us that Arena can steal the national treasury mind too, and he puts their mind to it. So it's not, I don't think it's a left-right thing. I think I think there are criminalized elements in all of the major parties, except for Tony Saca, who's entirely criminalized. There's no clean elements there. And I think the battle for the soul of both parties is that over the how that drug trafficking gang, illicit income, exploiting illicit structures is going to be used or not used. Mm-hmm.
But you also mentioned that, or we talked a little bit at the outset, so you have a weaker Venezuela. To a certain degree, Sanchez Cerén is a bit more alone in his regarding friends in the region, folks that would have the willingness, the capability to be able to work with him on things that he wants to work on. How will that affect Sanchez Cerén? Will he sort of, is he going to try to reach out to Nicaragua? Is he going to try to how will he try to make up for a lot of this necessary support that's sort of crumbling with, I guess, a traditional ally or the likely ally, which would be Venezuela?
Well, I think to me that's the big vulnerability of Sanchez Center right now is that he's going to, and you already see it with all the investments, is that there's no rational explanation for that amount of money coming into El Salvador. It certainly is not it's not PDVSA oil coming in because they can't maintain, they're not doing what they say as far as their oil exports are. It's also clear in talking to the FMLN folks that they view the Ortega model as the model. And having just been in Nicaragua for the first time in a long time, for an extended period, it's a good model. if you don't care about democratic institutions and that sort of thing, if you want a functioning model in which the corruption and drug trafficking is monitored at the very highest levels, but you have functioning community police, you have a lot of investment, you've cleaned up, everybody gets a piece, and the thing that Ortega did I think is brilliant, and I haven't understood the extent of it, he really has bought off all of his opponents, he's given every one of them something they really want and they're out of the way. So he and Rosario have cancha libre, and you know, free field to do with that, whatever they want. So, and it's not good in terms of democratic governance, that sort of stuff. But they view that as a model, and I think that somebody was talking about Ortega when he disappeared. I was in Nicaragua when he disappeared, and it was like, he's dead. And they really thought, a lot of people thought he really was. I think he was in Cuba getting treatment for his lupus. But he's in bad shape. There's no question he's in bad shape. And his ties to the historic Frente in Nicaragua differ very strongly from his wife's ties to the new generation of Sandinistas. There's going to be a mess down there, too. All of this to say, it opens up the need for a lot of money that they can't get through normal channels. And this is where I think the Jose Luis Merino, the Ramiro factor, will be viewed as more necessary because he can bring in money of unexplained origins into their coffers and replace a lot of money that's no longer that you would normally get from Venezuela or other international allies. And I think the temptation in the absence of other resources to rely more on that will be strong, and I don't think that Sanchez Cedillo has much will to resist it. Mm-hmm. I think there are other major players in the Frente who do, but Sanchez Cedillo and Ramiro are very close, and I don't think, and that's what I view that as a huge problem right now, or the main hole in vulnerability.
Sir? I'm Cesar Bolanes from the Navy. You mentioned Joaquin Villalobos. Do you foresee any possible communication between Sanchez Serén and Joaquin Villalobos?
No, they hate each other. No. I mean, I think when Joaquin cast his lot with Saca, which was, and I talked about it for hours, and he's a very smart guy, and he can give you all the reasons why it makes sense, except that it's El Salvador, it doesn't make any sense as to why that was the right thing. I think he really hurt himself this time. And the PDC with Ana Guadalupe and all those guys, I think, are pretty much even less relevant than they were going into this. Had Saca actually been the kingmaker and they had had some influence, it would have changed. You know, but it's a gamble that clearly did not pay off. And the sad thing is, it didn't pay off. He was wrong on that, but he was right on what you ended up with. It was this highly polarized society that's unable to break out of this traditional breakdown between Frente and Arena. And that's the tragedy. He was right on what the result of this would be. He was just wrong on whether soccer was a solution.
I'm going to ask you another question. So how serious do you think Sanchez Cedén will be about working with the United States and other countries on that one issue, which I guess would be sort of at the front for the United States, which is the narco-trafficking thing? I mean, you mentioned Ñorme Quijano coming out and being pretty tough on the Maras, even though he's talking to his base and it helps him politically. When the rubber hits the road, are we going to have a cooperative relationship or be able to work out a cooperative relationship with Sanchez Cedén's administration on narco-trafficking?
I don't think we know. I think that that will depend enormously on the internal negotiations going on now. I think that if, as there are some people have been saying, Sanchez Cedén would like to keep Munilla Páez as defense minister and some of the worst elements of the police in there, then I would say absolutely not. Then it's written off. There are some in the FMLN who really want to clean up the police. If you look historically, the last few 2 years or so. You had, from the peace process forward, a pretty good cúpula of the police, from the Areneros to the FMLN, it was pretty good. And then 2 years ago, when Munilla Páez becomes Minister of Security, he brings back the worst elements that all been exploded in the police, and essentially, destroys that institution. Hector Silva on Inside Crime is publishing a chapter that is broke on the demise of the Salvadoran police, which will be published by the UCA and El Salvador. But it's really, they publish, I think, 3 or 4 chapters on Inside Crime if you're interested in sort of the inner workings of the Salvadoran police and how it sort of fell apart. Really, really interesting stuff. So I think it will depend a lot on who Sanchez said it picks, who wins the fight over the security battle. There's going to be fights over the economy. He fights over a lot of stuff, and if the more, I would argue, clean, sano group of the FMLN wins the security battle, then you probably can have some cooperation. The problem on that, in that sense, will be that there'll probably be people the United States doesn't know and like very well, even if they're clean. If he goes with the current crew or something like that, or just shuffles around with the worst elements, then we have a problem because they're grossly incompetent, because they're bots. So you have, it's not going to, I think either way it's going to be a very difficult situation. And the big question is what they're going to do with the models, which they haven't told us yet.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Jorge Romero from the Spanish Embassy in Washington. No, I wanted to follow up on what you said about the outlook for the relation between the U.S. and Salvador under FMLN rule. And I think there's a bit of a contrast with the perception I got from the contacts we have had with U.S. officials, no? Which, in my opinion, they seem to be relatively optimistic, saying that, whoever leads the Salvador has to have an arrangement with the U.S., and also there are apparently polls we show that a very high proportion of people from Salvador have a more or less positive view of the U.S. Probably because they're the largest. and that even if people it's something that you can see here. You know, people living here by the U.S. they still are voting for some reason. They hate Arena or whatever, and they think that in the end. This means that Sanchez Pérez is going to be relatively pragmatic for some reason, also the decline of Venezuela, and probably he will have to pay lip service to some people who will be around him, and so he will have to make some gestures to prove that he has not departed from the traditional. But I was just highlighting this because I think there's a contrast between, and I don't know whether. U.S. officials are delusional on this, or yeah. But my perception is that they seem to be relatively optimistic, I see a contrast between this and your.
Well, I think until relatively recently, they were relatively optimistic. I think with the sort of comportment of the Frente and Funes particularly. In the last 6-8 months, has changed their perception considerably about what is doable. I mean, they also thought they could work with Funes, and clearly at the end of his time, at least for the first few years, I think yes, at the end of his time, no. That's put up a lot of caution flags for them. I think, I mean, Sanchez Cerén is a very smart guy. There's no question. He's not, he's arrogant, he's pompous, and he's very smart. And I think that he will do what he needs to do to survive, which I think the equation of this close, I think if he had won 60% and walked into the presidency, the incentive for having to pay attention to the more pragmatic wing of the Frente would have diminished. I think this strengthens the, I would call the more, not necessarily pragmatic, but the more democratic wing of the Frente, because they're the people who will have to do the outreach to the Arena. With the U.S., I think anybody has to have a relationship with the United States. There's no question about that. The question is can they have actual cooperation, you know, on the ground where you're talking counter-narcotics, where you're dealing with the gangs, where you're dealing with the Fondo Milenio, the two, which is, you know, not been approved with Funes, in part because I think the biggest indication of how far out of favor Funes has fallen is that he was all set up for the second tranche of the Millennium Fund, and he really blew it. You know, the decision was supported by bipartisan group in Congress and State Department and other folks eventually. That, I mean, when you had, you know, Leahy's people agreeing with who was the Republican that was big on that? It's one of the really conservative guys. They came out together against giving them the Fondo Milenio. You knew that Funes was in trouble because Leahy doesn't do that stuff lightly with somebody he supported. Anyway, so I think that's an indication of how the relationship has changed. I think that there was a feeling that the Frente, I don't think there's a feeling that you can't work with the Frente. I think there's a feeling that there are elements in the Frente that you probably can't work with. And if they're in control, you can't work with them. If they were marginalized, you probably could. And if they're in control, then you're going to have a much different situation. And I think the U.S. is also divided. I mean, you have some folks in the State Department who view everything, I would say, not benignly, as, you know, sort of, it's all good. You can work with whatever's there. And you have a lot of folks in the law enforcement community and other parts of the government who are much more skeptical. So I don't think you can talk about the U.S. in general, although obviously state would be the lead.
But I'd also think that a lot of folks here would look at the position of the United States as having sort of, or holding all the cards. I mean, the Millennium Challenge funds the compact, the issues of funding for narco-trafficking, cooperation on things like CAFTA, and the lack of a clear supporter regionally would probably make it sort of difficult for such a sit-in to maneuver. And so my question then is, a lot of these issues with narco-trafficking spill over into other countries in the region, in Central America. Don't you think that there would be a little bit of pressure from those countries for such a sit-in to sort of work on these issues because it's in their mutual interest to sort of do away with some of these issues with the maras or with the narcos?
Well, I think everything spills over into everything in Central America. Especially maras and transnational maras.
Yeah.
But look, I mean, if you look, I think this is to me the interesting and I would say worrisome thing about all the money. Because it's, if you have a flow of inexplicable, and you're talking right now, if you talk with people in El Salvador, they're talking hundreds of millions of dollars in all the money coming in. That means you can tell the United States to go take a hike.
Right.
Because we're going to give them 100 million, 80 million, I don't know what it was, but it's a lot less than, they're filling the void, and I would say that the inexplicable origin of the ALBA funds is worrisome. Primarily because it gives them an entirely different set of options into how to behave, in which the United States is then holding no cards.
Okay.
And I think if you look at the region, there's been no pressure on anyone in the Northern Triangle to clean up. I mean, Honduras is worse now than it was. Guatemala is not getting any better. El Salvador will probably get worse now that I would argue have the sort of political empowerment of the Maras and other and their. At least some sectors of them becoming much more linked to the drug trade in much more sort of active and organic ways than they have been in the past. That El Salvador will probably get worse. I think the pressure is to go, I mean, I think the pressure, and you hear Otto Molina talk about this too, is to go the Nicaraguan route. But what in Nicaragua is my version of the Nicaraguan model that may or may not be shared around the room. You know, Ortega manages the very upper level corruption, and everybody makes money. And he told them what were the conditions that his security people placed on the narco. There are no Mexicans on the ground, no maras, and no payment in kind. You have to pay in money so you don't create your internal consumption. You don't put Mexicans on the ground, and Ortega's unofficial structure makes sure it gets through. And when the Mexicans, Sinaloa sent people in 2009, you have them killed. And that was it. Okay, no more of this nonsense. The gang guys show up, he's had them killed too. And they, besides an entirely different environment for recruiting. And so what do you have? You have a booming economy, no violence, and everybody's making money off that. It's sort of a free transit zone in which everybody makes a lot of money. And people love it. You know, and I took a guy I work with from El Salvador, he does a lot of work with the gangs, he was like, I would live here. You know, screw democracy. This is great. You can ride bus any hour, day and night. You can walk any place you want. No one's going to extort you. If you do business, you're going to pay the corruption rate, but then nobody else will mess with you. In El Salvador, what do you have? Maras kidnapping your guards. You know, extortion, shooting up. You can't ride the bus from one part of the town to the other. It's horrible in comparison. So I think what they're shooting for, although there are many complicated factors to get there, is essentially, if there's pressure, it's toward the Democrat, it's toward the Nicaragua model, which doesn't do away with the crime, it manages it in ways that everyone finds acceptable. And I think that once that happens, you're in an entirely different ballgame. But I think one could argue that it's not going to be worse than what you're having. Never get back to democracy, constitutional law, or any of that stuff again, but it'll, everybody's lives may be a little better.
Questions? I have something that, something that continues to plague me. It's the issue of all the media hype up to the day of the election had him winning by 10 to 18%. So what did they do? Did people, all the Salvadorans fly in to vote? Was there money being spread out all over the country to get more Areneros to vote? Because my son even called me and said, hey dad, it's 0.4% difference. Because he has a friend that's, you know, went, a young guy down to help on the vote. So they brought in, or a lot of people came from outside of the United States to Salvador to have the impact. Is that how you?
I don't know how many people came in, but I think it's clear that Arena Big Money sat out the first round and played in the second round. And it's clear that a lot of Saca's voters went, you know, his 11, he got what, 11%, you know, a good chunk of that went to Arena, or you know, the vast majority of that went to Arena. And they put a lot of money into their get out the vote drive. I mean, because they had, I mean, you know, in round one, they really didn't have, it's shocking because Arena's always been sort of awash in money. I think people, a lot of businesses I knew who traditionally financed Arena sat out the first round because they didn't like Mogiano, they didn't like the campaign, they thought the party was sort of irreparably broken. But then when Sanchez said that, almost when they're like, "Holy shit, okay, you know, we better get back on. We're gonna have to play this round." And they really did, well, I think, want to teach, or you know, scare Quijano and that crowd for different reasons. But a lot of it has to do with this sort of internal corruption about it too. They wanted to get Paco Flores out. I mean, Paco Flores goes to the assembly to be questioned and said, "They said, did you take, you know, $10 million from the Taiwanese?" 10 million, I don't know, maybe it's 15 or 20. I mean, you know, what kind of arrogant imbecile does that? It's just, you know, in the middle of an election campaign, it doesn't help you. So you have, I think there were a lot of factors in Arena that the scare of the first round drove them to do it. One of my best sort of analyst friends down there was talking to me on Saturday and said, you know, Arena just might win. And I was like, what? He said, it's really changed, ambiente has changed, and the Frente maxed out in the first round. But I think they put a lot more money into it, and a lot of people who were on the sidelines. Plus, I mean, Saca was trying to be neutral, but was clearly going to be with the Frente, but his bosses were never going to do that. So they picked up that chunk, too. And I guess they said that this is the largest rise. Normally, the participation is less in the second round than it was in the first round. And here it went up 7%. And Arena got, you know, 400,000 more votes. So I think it was a combination of factors, and I think the Frente didn't worry about broadening out its message in the second round. They thought, okay, you know, we need 5 more votes to win. You know, screw it. We can just do it. You know, we don't have to worry about attracting new voters at this point, which they did in the first round, but they didn't need to go further.
So if Quijano ends up, if it holds, and that's what's likely to happen, we might have delays for whatever reason, but it's more likely that this outcome will hold. What kind of advice would you give Quijano's folks for dealing with, one, domestically, because it is a polarized environment, and two, for sort of making up ground here with the United States, and you're right, I mean, people like Tim Reeser, Senator Leahy are skeptical of that administration. You know, it's not a positive thing for them. How would you advise them?
Well, I mean, what I've told them when they've asked me is, you know, one, I would give the same advice to both parties. So, but if they do concrete things, if they were willing to do a few things on the internal trafficking structures, if they were willing to move to have the ALBA funds be much more transparent. I mean, I think that part of the issue with the ALBA money is that it's enormous and they're completely unwilling to explain where it comes from. If they said, okay, this is our accounting, this is, I mean, you may not like it. I don't particularly like all the money flowing in, but who cares? I mean, if it's transparent, then you vote on the transparency of the issue. Their complete unwillingness to discuss and justify their books on that is what I find most troubling. And when you're getting into hundreds of millions of dollars, it'd be nice to have some accounting, because if you look at what they should be getting in from what they declare, it should be about 17 to 20 million. And so I would say if you did a few things like that, if you did a few transparency things, if you went out of your way to have a really clean cupola in the police, and cleaned up that mess, and you get rid of Munir Payas, who I think is a cancer in the process, then people would say, okay, well, maybe, you know, maybe it's okay. I mean, I don't think the ideology matters to the U.S., going back to what the gentleman from the Spanish embassy is saying. I don't think they care that they're Frente. Mm-hmm. I don't think they care that they're, you know, whatever their ideology is. I think they care about their comportment, both internally and in the issues that we care about, and that's where I think the rub is. So if either side were giving clear indications, not that they were pro-U.S., but they were interested in rule of law and functioning police, either keep, you know, stop going after as soon as doing the Constitutional Court, which has done sort of incredibly good work in the recent times, the only sort of bastion of integrity left there. You can go for a really good procurador. Then people say, okay, we can deal with this. And I think if either side did that, because I think there's an enormous amount of skepticism about Arena too. The advantage from the U.S. point of view of having Arena is that there are pressure points the U.S. can exercise that, given the ALBA money, they can't exercise on the Frente. But I think that there's an enormous amount of problems with Arena's historical comportment, and they're running back to call for military coup. Initially, is, you know, shows that they have not evolved as much as one might have thought they had.
Any other questions?
All right, well, thanks.
Thank you.
This has been super insightful. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thanks.
Thanks, everybody, for coming.